Well, take your Bibles tonight. We're going to turn to Genesis chapter 39. Genesis 39. This is the most recent chapter that we've covered in our neighborhood fellowships. We were just there a couple of weeks ago, and as we're making our way through the book of Genesis, and so if you're in a neighborhood fellowship, this story tonight should be fresh in your minds. And it's also a story that's related to the Tempted and Tried series that I've been doing on Sunday nights, and so I just thought it'd be a good time to offer my thoughts on this chapter tonight. Now, prior to chapter 39, one of Joseph's 12 sons, by the name of Joseph, was sold into slavery by his brothers. Probably safe to say that they didn't like him very much. And one of the reasons they didn't like him very much was because he was his father's favorite son, which was pretty painfully clear to anyone who was observing any of it. Jacob made absolutely no bones about the fact that Joseph was his favorite. He didn't try to hide it at all. And perhaps the reason that Joseph was his favorite son was because he was the firstborn son to his favorite wife, Rachel. So not only did he have a favorite son, he also had a favorite wife of the four that he had. And so the thing is, Jacob really never wanted more than one wife. Even though he had four, he really only wanted one. He only ever wanted Rachel. He was simply tricked into marrying Leah, if you know the story in the book of Genesis. And then later on, more or less, he was coerced into marrying the two handmaids because of the bickering that was going on between Leah and Rachel. And so he ended up with four wives, but he only ever really wanted Rachel. That was the one woman that he wanted to marry. And so Joseph is special to Jacob because he was the firstborn son to the only wife he ever really wanted. And as his favorite, Jacob gave Joseph this fancy schmancy coat of many colors. And the coat may have been Jacob's way of telling the world that not only was Jacob his favorite son, but also that perhaps that he considered Joseph to be his real legitimate firstborn son rather than the literal firstborn son of Leah, if that makes sense. He's the firstborn son to the wife, the only wife he ever really wanted. And so there may have been some subversive meaning to the coat in that sense. And obviously the other sons didn't like that, right? So they didn't like the fact that Joseph was their father's favorite, didn't like the fact that he had this coat with this potentially subversive message to it. And then the brothers also thought that Joseph had a bad attitude because he's walking around in his fancy coat and he's talking about these dreams that he had where he would be the one who would be lording over the rest of the family. And so that was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back, and they were pretty much fed up with Joseph. And one day, while they were out, away from home, tending their sheep, the brothers decided they were going to kill Joseph. However, Reuben, the oldest of the brothers, stepped in providentially and stopped it. And instead, Judah came up with the idea that they're going to sell Joseph into slavery. And they could get rid of him and make some quick cash at the same time. And so that sounded good to all of them, and they made this plan, and that's what they did. And so when you get to chapter 39, Joseph is now a slave. And verse 1 says that Joseph was brought down to Egypt. He was taken from Canaan and brought to Egypt. And going from Canaan and to Egypt would have involved a little bit of culture shock for Joseph, because Egypt wasn't at all like his father's home in Canaan. Jacob worshipped the one true God, and he led his family to worship the one true God. And while the Egyptians worshipped literally thousands of gods and goddesses, in fact, they were pretty much slaves to their idol worship. While Joseph was a literal slave, the Egyptians were slaves to their religious superstitions. Every morning at sunrise, they would chant cultic hymns to wake up the gods from sleep. They would ritually bathe their idols and dress them in fancy clothes. And then they would bring them breakfast as part of their morning offering. Even though they never touched their breakfast, they would bring it to them every day. And they had gods for pretty much everything. Even Pharaoh himself was considered a god. And so Joseph was immersed in this new pagan culture. And verse 1 in chapter 39 says, "And Joseph was brought down to Egypt, And Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard, an Egyptian, bought him of the hands of the Ishmaelites, which had brought him down thither. And so he was sold to a man by the name of Potiphar. And Potiphar was a high-ranking government official. It says in this verse that he was the captain of the guard, which means that he was responsible for the king's personal safety, also for the security of the prisoners, and for carrying out the sentences of all the prisoners, which would include executions. And so here's Joseph. He's been forcibly separated from his family. He's rejected by his brothers. He's sold as a slave. And he's in a place that's about as pagan as you can get. And so he's in this very difficult situation. It's fairly desperate for him, which to me makes verse 2 rather amazing. When it says in verse 2, it says, "And the Lord was with Joseph, and he was a prosperous man. And he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian." He was a prosperous man. So let's see. His brothers wanted him dead. He's sold into slavery. He has no money. All he has is the clothes on his back. He's friendless. He's hopeless. He's alone. He's a stranger in every sense of the word. And yet, verse 2 says that he was prosperous. Isn't that interesting? He was a prosperous man. And what reason does it give in verse 2 about why he was prosperous? Anyone see that? What does it say in verse 2? Why was he prosperous? The Lord was with him, right? So the Lord was with him, and the Lord made him prosperous. And when it uses that word Lord there, that's a translation of the name Yahweh or Jehovah in Hebrew, which is the personal covenant name of God. It's the same name that God gave to Moses at the burning bush. It's used 8 times in this chapter. every time you see the word Lord appear in this chapter, it's that name Jehovah or Yahweh. But the interesting thing is that the name Jehovah is never used again in the remaining 8 chapters of the story of Joseph. It's used 8 times in this chapter, but then not used again after that, except when Jacob is on his deathbed, it's used again. And each time it's used in this chapter, it conveys this idea of the Lord is with Joseph and blessing him. And so it's also interesting to note that there's no character in this story that uses the name Jehovah anywhere. No individual, no person uses the name Jehovah. It's only the author, through the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, that uses the name Jehovah, who inserts it into the narrative. And I believe he does that really to help us understand what's going on in the background of the story. And so what we need to understand here is that at the most uncertain time of Joseph's life, when he thought he was as far away from God as he possibly could be, when he's in the most desperate situation you could think of, that God was right there with him, that Jehovah was right there with him, even though he was alone in Potiphar's house in a place saturated with the culture of idolatry. God was with him, and he was at work behind the scenes. And Joseph was prosperous because God was with him. But then you have to ask yourself, what does it actually mean to be prosperous? If Joseph is prosperous, you know, what does it mean to be prosperous? Because being a penniless slave doesn't really fit any definition of prosperity, modern definition of prosperity that I know of. But then I would say that the Bible's view of prosperity is a little different than ours. In Proverbs 10:22, it says that it's the blessing of the Lord that makes you rich and not necessarily money. In fact, you find that the Bible has a lot of disparaging things to say about money in many different places. And so prosperity isn't always associated with financial wealth. In fact, God can prosper us in whatever circumstance or whatever context we find ourselves in, whether we're sweeping floors at the local grocery store or whether we're serving as a CEO of a major corporation. You can be equally prosperous in either one of those situations or in any situation. Because it has less to do with money and more to do with excelling at the work that God has given us. Prosperity can even come in the form of slavery or a prison cell, and which was obviously Joseph's situations. And so Joseph was prospering in the work that God had given him. And he was determined to work as if he were working for God. If he was going to be a slave, he'd be the best slave he could possibly be. If he was going to be a prisoner, he'd be the best prisoner he could possibly be. He was determined to honor God in everything he did, just like 1 Corinthians 10:31 says, "Whatsoever ye do, do all to the glory of God." And that was Joseph's mindset. And so the blessings that God pours on us are not always measured by our bank account. It says in verse 3, "And his master saw that the Lord was with him, and that the Lord made all that he did to prosper in his hand. And Joseph found grace in his sight, and he served him and made him overseer over his house, and all that he had he put into his hand. And it came to pass from the time that he had made him overseer in his house and over all that he had, that the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. And the blessing of the Lord was upon all that he had in the house and in the field. And he left all that he had in Joseph's hand, and he knew not aught he had save the bread which he did eat. And Joseph was a goodly person and well favored." And so even Potiphar, this pagan Egyptian, could see that the Lord was with Joseph. And he learned very quickly that Joseph did everything better than anyone else did. And because of that, he put all of everything in his house basically under his stewardship. And it's a pretty amazing thing to think of. I mean, can you imagine what kind of talent and capability that Joseph must have had, that Potiphar was willing to put this teenage Hebrew slave in charge of his entire household, make him in charge of everything? And yet, that's exactly what he did. He must have had a level of diligence and integrity that was just amazing. It even got to the point where Potiphar didn't even have to think about what Joseph was doing, because he knew that whatever he was doing, it was perfect. The only thing he ever had to think about was what's for dinner. Verse 6 says that Joseph was a goodly person and well-favored, which simply means that he was a very good-looking young man. And for what it's worth, there's only one other person in the Bible that's described that way, and that's Rachel, his mother. Unfortunately, the fact that he's a goodly person leads him into his next problem in verse 7. It says, "And it came to pass after these things that his master's wife cast her eyes upon Joseph, and she said, 'Lie with me.' She saw him and she wanted him." It was nothing more than obviously physical attraction. And it simply says in verse 8 that Joseph refused. It says, "But he refused and said unto his master's wife, 'Behold, my master wotteth not,'" or in other words, he doesn't worry about what is with me in the house, "and he hath committed all that he hath into my hand. There is none greater in this house than I, neither hath he kept back anything from me but thee, because thou art his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?" And so he refused. And his refusal was based on three things. First of all, it would be an abuse of trust, because Potiphar placed everything that he had into his hands, and he would not betray that trust. Secondly, it was an offense to her husband, and she was married, and he refused to defile the sanctity of marriage. And then finally, it was a sin against God. And so the bottom line is that he feared God more than he feared anything else. And so Joseph was concerned about his integrity, the institution of marriage, and his fellowship with God. But, you know, it's interesting that some people could take those same three reasons and turn them into excuses to go ahead and commit the sin, right? The master, you could say something like this: "The master doesn't know I'm here, and so how would he ever find out," right? Joseph could have said something like that, or he could have said, "I'm the boss, he's put me over everyone in the house except her, and she wants to, so why not? Who's going to stop me," right? Or, "Yeah, it's a sin, but everything's covered under the blood, so, you know, it's all good," right? And if we're not careful, we can talk ourselves into justified in pretty much anything, any kind of a sin that we want to engage in. You can find reasons. You can take the same reasons for not doing something and twist them into reasons for doing something. Well, Potiphar's wife doesn't give up. She says in verse 10, or it says in verse 10, "And it came to pass, as she spake to Joseph day by day, that he hearkened not unto her to lie by her or to be with her. And it came to pass about this time that Joseph went into the house to do his business. And there was none of the men of the house there within. And she caught him by his garment, saying, 'Lie with me.' And he left his garment in her hand and fled and got him out." And so she kept after him day after day after day after day. And she even tried to make it sound less, you know, offensive, right? "Listen, you don't have to lie with me. Just come spend some time with me." But Joseph didn't relent, and he maintained his integrity. And until one day, he ended up alone in the house with her, and she grabbed him, and he did the only thing that he had left to do. You know, he pulled himself out of his shirt, and he ran. You know, it's interesting. Potiphar left everything in Joseph's hands, right? Everything in his house in Joseph's hands in verse 6. But now Joseph's garment is left in Potiphar's wife's hand. The first one shows Potiphar's trust in Joseph, but the second one shows Joseph's faithfulness to Potiphar. Verse 13, it says, "And it came to pass, when she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and was fled forth, that she called unto the men of her house and spake unto them, saying, See, he hath brought in an Hebrew unto us to mock us. He came in unto me to lie with me, and I cried with a loud voice. And it came to pass, when he heard that I lifted up my voice and cried, that he left his garment with me and fled and got him out. And she laid up his garment by her until his Lord came home." And so she was left with his shirt in her hand, and she's so angry that she comes up with this story, you know, about how he tried to force himself on her. And she tells that story to all the men in the house, and then waits for her husband to come home so that she can tell him too. But I think it's interesting, the language that's used in verse 16. It says that she laid up his garment by her until his Lord came home, not her Lord, right? Joseph was obedient and faithful to Potiphar, so you could say that he was his Lord, but Potiphar's wife was neither obedient nor faithful to her husband, so you couldn't say that she was, or that Potiphar was her Lord. Verse 17 says, "And she spake unto him according to these words, saying," speaking to Potiphar now, "saying, The Hebrew servant which thou hast brought unto us came in unto me to mock me. And it came to pass, as I lifted up my voice and cried, that he left his garment with me and fled out. And it came to pass, when his master heard the words of his wife, which she spake unto him, saying, After this manner did thy servant to me, that his wrath was kindled. And Joseph's master took him and put him into prison, a place where the king's prisoners were bound, and he was there in prison." And so she takes the same story that she told the men of the household and tells her husband, Potiphar. But there's some subtle differences between the two versions of the story. The first story to the men of the house was meant to enlist their support, while the second story to her husband was meant to incite his rage. And she tells the men of the house, "See, he hath brought in a Hebrew unto us to mock us. He came in unto me to lie with me, and I cried with a loud voice." And if there's a subtle prejudice involved in this version of the story. She's saying he brought in a Hebrew, and she's trying to play on the men of the household, their nationalistic, xenophobic fears, right? Their prejudices against foreigners. And she says that he came in to mock us, implying that, you know, his offense was against them just as much as it was against her, and she's identifying with them. So she's trying to elicit, you know, their support. But then the story subtly shifts when she tells her husband. And in verse 17, she says, "The Hebrew servant which thou hast brought unto us came unto me to mock me." And so it's no longer a Hebrew. It's now a Hebrew servant, a slave. And to be attacked by a Hebrew was bad enough, but to be attacked by a Hebrew slave was even worse. And then she implies that Potiphar was partially to blame. She says that this is the Hebrew servant that you brought into the house to mock us. And so she's trying to make him feel guilty and to obligate him to doing something. And then she says, ends by saying that he came to mock me, to underscore her own personal devastation by the whole event. And apparently her deception worked, because it says that his wrath was kindled. But did you notice it doesn't say who his wrath is kindled against? It just says that his wrath was kindled. And it makes me wonder, you know. I think Potiphar knows firsthand, first of all, what kind of person Joseph is, that he's a man of integrity. He's proven himself over time. He knows that he's a man of character. And he's been a great servant, and he's made him extremely prosperous ever since he's been in his house. While on the other hand, he also likely knows the kind of person that his wife is, that she lacks perhaps a certain amount of moral character. Because I would say that because this kind of thing doesn't happen in isolation, doesn't happen in a vacuum. There's usually more involved than just one incident, right? When it comes to sexual sin, there's usually a pattern involved. And so there may have been some other questionable incidents with Potiphar's wife. And certainly she behaves like a woman who gets what she wants. And even when she's propositioning Joseph, she uses very blunt, crass words when she propositions him, so she's used to getting what she wants. And so I'm guessing that maybe his anger may have been burning not so much against Joseph, and maybe more so against his wife. I wonder about that. But if that's true, then it puts Potiphar in a very difficult situation, a position, because his wife already told the whole house about the incident before he got home, you know, and so he couldn't just discount the accusation without publicly humiliating his wife, even if he suspects that maybe she's lying. Well, on the other hand, you know, how can he punish Joseph for such a serious offense when perhaps he doesn't really believe that he's guilty? In Egypt, attempted rape was punishable by death, and especially if the crime is committed by a slave against the wife of a government official. Consider the seriousness of this accusation. A high government official, a slave in his household, attempting to rape his wife. On top of that, Potiphar himself is the captain of the guard, and he's responsible for executions. He's responsible for prisoners, and he's responsible for the sentences that are given to prisoners, including executions. And so he could have very easily put Joseph to death on the spot, and no one would likely have questioned it. But instead, what he does is he chooses to put Joseph into prison, which to me is perhaps a strong indication that he really didn't believe the story. And the other thing is that the prison also happens to be in Potiphar's house, which you find out from chapter 40 in verse 3, where it says, he put him in ward in the house of the captain of the guard into the prison, the place where Joseph was bound. So it's in the house of the captain of the guard, which is Potiphar. And so Potiphar put him into prison in his own house, which might also help to explain why the keeper of the prison was so quick to put Joseph in charge as well, because he was already familiar with him. In verse 21, it says, but the Lord was with Joseph and showed him mercy and gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison committed to Joseph's hand all the prisoners that were in the prison, and whatsoever they did there, he was the doer of it. The keeper of the prison looked not to anything that was under his hand, because the Lord was with him, and that which he did, the Lord made it to prosper. And so it's kind of like deja vu, right? We're told that God was with him and showed him mercy, and he's again exalted to a position of leadership over the whole prison. He earns favor with the keeper of the prison, just like he earned favor with Potiphar. And just like Potiphar, the keeper of the prison, put everything into Joseph's hands, and he didn't pay attention to anything that Joseph did because he knew that it was being done right. So it's almost a carbon copy of the experience that he had with Potiphar, he has with the keeper of the prison. Well, you know, in a lot of ways, this chapter is about temptation. And temptation is very much a universal thing. I don't care who you are. If you are a living, breathing human being, you are suffering from temptation. We all do. We all suffer from temptation. And one of the sobering things about temptation is the fact that it reveals who we really are by the way that we respond to it. C.S. Lewis said, no man knows how bad he is until he's tried to be good. In other words, you know, we don't really know what kind of person we are deep down until we're compelled to choose between right and wrong. Under the stress of temptation. And as a Christian, our character is always being formed. And much of the time, it's being formed imperceptibly. Unconsciously, we take sides on moral issues and we choose how we're going to conduct ourselves. But it takes that moment of truth when we're tempted and tested for that choice to actually come out. And when it does, it reveals the true nature of our own character. And it can be sometimes eye-opening and devastating, really, when that happens. Another important thing to know about temptation is that it has the ability to either strengthen us or weaken us, depending on how we react to it. If we depend on God and through His power resist the temptation, we will become more resolute. It will be easier for us to resist the next time, and our walk with God will be stronger. But if we fall to temptation and give in to sin, it will be much harder to resist the next time, and we'll fall much more easily. And we'll grow weaker and fall deeper as time goes on into sin. It's true that little sins lead to bigger sins. And if you think about Joseph and you think about his life, his whole life followed a pattern of moral accountability. He was faithful in the smallest of things. He consistently resisted temptation before it got out of control. And it was the power of that pattern of his life that really was a big factor. It helped him to resist the onslaught of temptation from Potiphar's wife. The classic passage on temptation is 1 Corinthians 10:13. It says in 1 Corinthians 10:13, "There hath no temptation taken you, but such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not suffer you to be tempted above that you're able, but will with the temptation also make a way to escape that ye may be able to bear it." So there's three things in this verse that we need to understand. First of all, temptation happens to all of us. No one's immune, like I just mentioned, right? We're all subject to temptation. And it's not a sin to be tempted. Jesus himself was tempted in the wilderness, right? It's only a sin when you give in to that temptation and you fall into sin. That's when it becomes a sin. But the temptation itself is not a sin, and we're all subject to it. Secondly, the second thing that you get from that verse is the fact that God would not allow us to be tempted to the point where we can't resist. The pressure could be incredible, and it may feel like that we have no choice, but it says that God is faithful. God is faithful, and he will give you the ability to handle it if you simply yield to him and his ability to keep you from sin. Thirdly, the third thing you get from that verse is the fact that God gives us an escape route. It's up to us simply to take advantage of whatever escape route he gives us. You know, the temptation will most likely return, but God will always put us in a position to have that escape route. So let's consider Joseph in this story. You could probably go through this chapter, and you could probably find multiple ways that he was tempted in this chapter. But I think the first temptation that Joseph faced was the temptation to give up. When he was first taken prisoner and put into Potiphar's wife, he could have just fallen to the depths of despair, right? And fallen to the temptation of giving up. He had lost everything. He no longer had his home or his family, lost his wealth, all comfort. And it would have been really easy for him to just withdraw and get depressed and say, you know, why me, Lord? And turn his focus inward and really lose hope. But instead, Joseph made a conscious decision to trust God. And he didn't know why all of this was happening to him, but he did know that he needed to serve God in whatever circumstance he found himself in. And so he was determined to serve others as if he were serving God. If he was going to be a slave, he'd be the best slave he could be. If he's going to be a prisoner, he'd be the best prisoner. And he made the determination to honor God in everything he did, as 1 Corinthians 10:31 says, "Whether therefore ye eat or drink, or whatsoever ye do, do all to the glory of God." And so he faced that temptation to give up in despair, and he's victorious over it. And the Lord blessed him because of that. But obviously the more larger and more obvious temptation he faced in this chapter was the temptation to engage in the immoral behavior, right, that Potiphar's wife was trying to get him to do. And I think this story can be useful for us because of the way that he dealt with that larger temptation gives us more or less a blueprint for the way that we can also deal with temptation in our lives. There are five things that Joseph did when he was tempted by Potiphar's wife. And these five things are the same kind of things that we can do when we're faced with temptation as we try to resist temptation. And the first thing that he did is he refused the temptation immediately. He refused the temptation immediately. He never entertained the thought of it. He didn't ruminate over it. He just simply refused it out of hand. And the problem is with most Christians is that they typically don't do that. You know, while most Christians will say that they want to resist temptation, at the same time, they also would really want to be tempted. And they want to be propositioned first. They want to flirt with the idea. And they want to think about it. They want to see how far they can go without getting into trouble, right? And so they stare and they fantasize, or they say no, but they toy with the idea of saying yes. And so they play with it. And instead of acting decisively in the beginning, they delay their response. And the longer, unfortunately, that you wait to say no, the harder it becomes to say no. And the more you dabble with the idea, the weaker you become. And the moment that we allow ourselves to debate the merits of wrong behavior, we give our flesh the fire and the boldness that it feeds on, that it needs to give in to that sin. 2 Corinthians 10 and verse 3 says, "For though we walk in the flesh, we do not war after the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds, casting down imaginations and every high thing that exalteth itself against the knowledge of God, and bringing into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ." We have a habit of building strongholds in our minds, these fortresses that are like they're impenetrable, and we defend these things tooth and nail, these strongholds in our minds. Behind the walls of those fortresses, those strongholds in our minds, we typically will hold certain sins or temptations that we like to fantasize about. We like to treasure those things in certain ways. And in our battle against sin, you know, we'll do away with a lot of sinful things in our life, but we won't do away with those things that are behind the wall of that stronghold in our mind. Because those are the things that we like. That's our secret pleasure and our secret sin. Yet 2 Corinthians 10 says to cast down those imaginations, pull down those strongholds. You know, if you're a Christian, your goal should be to have a life where you don't sin at all. Unfortunately, too many Christians, have the goal of not to sin very much. And if that's your goal, you've really already begun to lose the battle. And so the first thing he did was he refused temptation immediately. That's the thing that we need to do. Refuse temptation immediately. The second thing that Joseph did was he realistically counted the cost of the sin. He realistically counted the cost of the sin. He knew that if he gave in, it would be an abuse of trust, that he would defile himself, that he would defile the institution of marriage, and ultimately he would sin against God. And when we face temptation, it's so easy to get caught up in the pleasure of the moment that we never really stop to think about the price. We never stop to think about the damage and the destruction that we're going to leave in our wake. And that's especially true with immorality, with sexual sin. Immorality is not just a personal thing. It has ripple effects that impact everyone around us. It steals something irreplaceable from our spouse or from our future spouse if you're not married. It undermines our testimony to unsaved people who know us or know about us in our community. It destroys our credibility and perhaps an opportunity to serve and minister. It causes embarrassment and anger and disappointment from family and friends, and it even impacts their character simply by being associated with us. And if we would simply just stop and count the cost, I think it would have a very strong dampening effect on our desire for sin. We have to stop and count the cost. The third thing that Joseph did was he resisted the temptation and pressure persistently. He resisted it persistently. Potiphar's wife wouldn't let up, would she? She just hounded him every day, and she came at him from every angle. But Joseph resisted persistently, and he had a steadfast determination to stay pure. It says in verse 10 that she spake to Joseph day by day, but it also says that he hearkened not unto her. Temptation is not a once-and-done kind of thing, right? Temptation is an ongoing issue. Joseph didn't deal with temptation in one single momentous occasion. He had to deal with it every day, just like we do. Temptation never takes a day off. It's always stalking us. And so when we're tempted, really, it shouldn't take us by surprise. We should really be ready for it because we know it's coming. Tomorrow, we're going to be tempted in one way or another. All of us will be tempted. And the repetitive nature of temptation can never be used as an excuse to go ahead and fall into sin, because we're all going to be tempted repeatedly. And that's just the way it is. Resist temptation persistently. 2 Thessalonians 3:13 says, "Be not weary in well-doing." The fourth thing that Joseph did was he strategically avoided tempting situations. Strategically avoided tempting situations. Joseph stayed away from Potiphar's wife as much as he possibly could. He knew that she was trouble and he didn't want any part of it. And so he didn't allow himself to be with her. And that obviously makes sense, right? This really isn't rocket science. You stay away from those things that you find tempting. If you know that something is a temptation to you personally, whatever that thing is, you need to stay away from it. If you have friends who encourage you to sin, avoid them, right? If you have certain places that stir up sinful emotions for you, then don't go there. If a certain person tempts you, don't be around them. Certainly don't be around them alone. Make sure someone is always with you. The thing is, if you find yourself gravitating to those kind of situations, if you find yourself, like, you want to go to these kind of places where you're going to be tempted, that's only because you want to be tempted, right? You know that you're going to be tempted. And like I said, it's not rocket science. You want to flirt with the idea. You want to see how far you can go without getting into trouble. But you need to be warned because you're playing with fire. The closer you get to temptation, the harder it is to say no. So avoid tempting situations. Then the fifth thing Joseph did was he fled decisively. His job required him to be in the house. But when Potiphar's wife confronted him and grabbed him, he didn't stop to think about it. He just ran. He didn't stop to think about what he was going to do. Verse 12 says, he left his garment in her hand and fled and got him out. Sometimes we just need to get us out of whatever situation that we find ourselves in. Get away from those things that make us uncomfortable and the circumstances that we shouldn't be in. Joseph got out. And he got out because there was no one else that was going to come rescue him out of that situation. It was just him and her. And he had to flee. He took the only way of escape that he had left, and he ran. And the only way that he could flee decisively was if he had made up his mind in advance, right? Does that make sense? He would have had to already thought through this scenario, or at least known what he would do if he were ever confronted with this kind of situation. He had to have his mind made up in advance. He wasn't dancing around in the heat of the moment thinking, you know, what am I going to do? He immediately knew what he was going to do. He was going to flee. And so you have to ask yourself, what are you going to do, you know, when you're tempted, the next time you face temptation? If you wait until it happens, it'll be too late. So you have to decide now. Paul said, flee temptation in 1 Corinthians 6:18. In 2 Timothy 2:22, he said, flee also youthful lusts. Those aren't just figures of speech. Those are actually a battle plan against temptation. So the window of opportunity is to flee is small, and so you have to decide in advance and run quickly. Well, temptation, like I said, is very revealing. It shows us who we are. But in the end, I believe one of the real keys to resisting temptation lies in already knowing who you are, or whose you are. And that's one of the things I've talked about in the Tempted and Tried series, is understanding your true identity. If you're a Christian, you're bought with a price, and you belong to God. And just like Joseph, you're a slave. In fact, you're a bond slave to Jesus Christ. And so there's no question about our obligation to our master, right? And so we just need to be as determined to remain as faithful to our master as Joseph was to his. Now, there's just one last temptation I want to leave you with tonight. And it's probably the most, most wicked of all temptations. And that's the temptation to turn away from the free offer of salvation. Of all the things that Satan wants to keep you from, this is probably absolutely number one on the list. If he can turn you away from Christ, he'll do it. If he can give you, you know, toys to distract you and keep you oblivious to your need of salvation, he'll do that. If he needs to fill your head with foolish thinking, he'll do that. If he needs to make you religious, he'll do that. Whatever it takes, he'll do whatever it takes to keep you from turning to Christ. But the thing is, the temptation to turn away from the free offer of salvation is just a temptation, just like any other temptation. And if you're tempted to turn away from receiving Christ as your Savior, then I would encourage you to use the same strategy to overcome that temptation as you would for any other. Number one, refuse immediately all those distractions that Satan throws your way. The longer you think about the toys and the lifestyle and all the other distractions of life, the more likely you'll fall for Satan's lie instead of the truth. Number two, count the cost of not receiving Christ. The cost is eternal loss and suffering, but the gain is eternal life. Number three, persistently avoid those voices that would tell you that you're making a mistake, that you're throwing your life away, when the reality is that you're not throwing your life away, you're actually receiving life for the very first time when you receive Christ. And then finally, flee decisively to Christ. Turn to him now. Refuse the temptation to put it off to another time. Jesus has made a way of escape, and the window of opportunity is small, so you need to run to him quickly for salvation. Obviously, this is a Sunday evening crowd, and so I don't expect that there's anyone here who doesn't know Christ as their Savior. But certainly, we all know people who do need to know Christ as their Savior. So I'd encourage you to be faithful witnesses and lead others to Christ. Do you guys have any thoughts tonight about any of this?